Welcome back to another episode of the Generation Hustle Podcast. Episode 69 is with Robbie Crabtree, founder of Performative Speaking. Robbie is a retired trial lawyer, turned startup founder coach, turning founders into powerful storytellers. Having started his career in the legal sector, Robbie helped victims get justice for violent felonies, murders, and child abuse cases as a successful trial lawyer. After 8 years of competitive storytelling in a courtroom with 102 jury trials, Robbie realized that his ability to curate a story can be used for much more. Since shifting his focus to helping founders in seed to series C levels as a strategic advisor and coach, Robbie has helped clients raise over $135 million in venture funding, build companies worth billions, and make their vision a reality. We talked to Robbie about his career pivot from lawyer to startup coach. He explains the makings of a great storyteller, how to pick up on cues when people are lying, and the mistakes that founders make with pitch decks. He also details the steps to scaling his influence and how to balance authenticity with growth. This is a great conversation with so many learnings throughout that we hope you enjoy.
To start off, we always like to get a little elevator pitch from our guests just to understand where you're from, what you do, and how you find yourself here today.
So first off, thanks for having me. Excited to chat. And when I think about the elevator pitch, right, one of my friends, Clay Bear, who was early with Seth Godin working with him, actually has this like stance that the elevator pitch is dead and that it doesn't actually serve any purpose. So anytime I hear that, I immediately just hear Clay Bear's words in my head of like, doesn't exist. What I do think like is really valuable is like kind of this statement, right, of like, what do I do? And I think of it like this, right? I help startup founders to tell their story, to fundraise, recruit talent, and connect to their customers. And really, that's what it all boils down to. And if we think about how I got here, it's been a little bit of a crazy journey. Obviously, we'll have time to go into that fully. But like originally, I was a trial lawyer. I spent 7 years trying 102 jury trials. That led me into thinking that I had this crazy idea that I could basically teach to like Silicon Valley type Richards, that they could speak better on stage so that they didn't have to hand it off to Ehrlich Bachman. And here I am today and have helped clients raise over $120 million in the last 12 months through this kind of storytelling process that I've brought from the trial world into the startup world.
Can you talk to us about your experience as a lawyer and kind of how that shaped your entrepreneurial skills? Like how that pushed you into kind of foraying into this?
You know, early on, because I was a prosecutor, I was working for the state, right, for the government. And so you're not really having to do much of like the entrepreneurial side of things. Cases just come to me. Like I had anywhere from 100 to 250 cases as a felony prosecutor for my entire career. I never had to go and find people because guess what? People are committing crimes all day. So it's not a hard ask when you're working for the government. So I didn't have to worry about that. But what I did have to learn is a lot of like, you know, case management, triage. How do you talk to clients? How do you manage those expectations? How do you have a lot of these interactions? And you deal with a lot of things too, of like, you know, you're talking to a judge who thinks that they're almighty, all powerful, godlike complexes. And then you're speaking to the opposing attorney who, like, are they friends? Are they trying to like take your legs out from you? Like, how are you playing that game? Then you've got your own employees, and it's kind of a battle internally too, because there's politics, because you want to move up in the office and they want to move up, but there's only so many spots. And so there's a lot of different dynamics that you end up playing in that world that does translate really nicely into the entrepreneurial world. And as I think about it, the biggest piece, right, that took me into the space I'm today is the way that it taught me how to be like a speaker, how to deliver my message. And being a trial lawyer ultimately comes down to being a competitive storyteller. The person who tells the best story is the person that wins. Right. Well, guess what? That is the same thing that is required in business. If you want to build a brand, if you want to build loyalty, why do people continue to buy an iPhone, even though there may be better phones out there? It's because you identify with the story of Apple, of I am somebody who thinks differently. I'm an Apple user. I'm one of those crazy ones. So when we think about it, it's just competitive storytelling in business as well. So I've just brought those skills into what I do now as an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. So you said, you know, working as a lawyer, you didn't have to go find clients. It kind of just came to you. Did you know, like a lot of people will find that comfortable, right? You don't have to go out and kind of do that extra work. So did you kind of know that eventually you would kind of move out of this type of work, or, you know, how did that start? Like, when did that start kind of clicking for you?
I think it was 2017 when I was coming back from a trip to Morocco, actually. And I was sitting with my partner at the time. And I told her, I was like, I got to figure out a way to be an entrepreneur. I got to figure a way to get out of being a lawyer in some ways. And not because I didn't enjoy being a lawyer. I did. Like, I totally did. But you also could see, like, as I was moving up in the office, I was trying super serious cases at a very, very early stage because I was getting results. you know, I'm trying murder cases in my third year of being a trial lawyer. I'm watching people go away for the rest of their life based on like what I'm doing. And you get to a certain point, you're like, well, what is next? Like, what's higher than that in terms of the work I'm doing, right? So I kind of had this idea that I wanted to do child abuse cases because those were super serious too. That ended up being like the last piece I did as a prosecutor in like 2019. I spent a year as a child abuse prosecutor only trying those cases. But it was on that flight in 2017 where I was like, I need to figure out a way. But the struggle I had was this. I was like, in order to be an entrepreneur, in my head, I needed to be someone who could code. I needed to be a, you know, a software engineer. I needed to be a computer science person. I was like, I don't have any of those skills. Could not be further away from any of those skills. And so I just sat there talking to her. I was like, I don't know what the thing is. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I know I want this, but I'm not sure what it is. So I basically just kind of put that pin in it, right? And just kind of let it marinate and sit and think through. And I always had this idea that I wanted to hit 100 jury trials. I knew I wasn't there yet because I knew if I hit 100 jury trials, I could leverage that in so many different ways because that basically puts me in the top 1% of 1% of trial lawyers in the US. So like I knew once you hit that point, you can take it wherever you want to go. And it wasn't until like late 2019 that I really saw there's this huge need for it because people started coming to me. Actually, people on my juries would come and ask, like they would be business leaders. They'd be entrepreneurs themselves and say, Robbie, can you help us? Like you're really good at explaining these ideas, at convincing us. Like, can you teach me? And that was kind of that aha moment where I was like, oh, that's the thing that I could go out and do. And then I realized it was like the tech founders that were this biggest need, this biggest pain point to go out and help because they're building these massively successful companies, but oftentimes doing a really terrible job of explaining what they're doing. So it's very hard for your average day person to understand. So I wanted to go and fix that problem. That's ultimately what led me to this place.
That's really cool. And that's a very common feeling, I think. A lot of people, especially in our age demographic, they want to be an entrepreneur and they want to build something of their own, but they don't know what they want to do or how they're going to go about it. So it's really cool how that clicked for you. Once that did click, how did you kind of go about making that transition into building out your business?
At that point, what it really came down to was letting people outside of my current world know what I had to offer, right? Because I was a trial lawyer in Dallas, Texas. I didn't know a single person in venture. I didn't know a single person in the startup ecosystem. I didn't have any ties to Silicon Valley. I'd been to San Francisco one time in my life. And that was like a quick little visit for a mock trial tournament that I was coaching the national mock trial team at SMU with. So I said, I've got to find a way to start connecting with these people and have them see like how my skill set translates. And what I really thought about was kind of like the model of Chris Voss and what he's done with the FBI hostage negotiator into working with a lot of business leaders. Same with Jocko Willink, right? Takes his Navy SEAL training and turns it into business consulting. And I was like, okay, those are two examples. How did they do that? Well, they wrote books. They started to put their ideas out there. They just started talking about their expertise and saying, this is the way it applies to what you're doing. So for me, I just follow that same playbook. Tweet, write articles, talk to people, go on podcasts, do all those sort of things, create videos. And all of a sudden, it started to catch on, right? And that's really where things kind of took off is once people kind of started to associate, and this is where it takes some time, right? You've got to be steady. You've got to be persistent, if you will, and you've got to stay on message so that when people think storytelling or they think startup fundraising, it's like, I know a guy like Robbie does this. And you want to start seeing yourself getting tagged on threads or being like commented on and people asking for your opinion so that you know your messaging is sinking in. And that's really what I was looking for. Once I started to see those kind of signs, I started to see that signal, right? And then I just dove in harder and harder and harder and harder and built that out where there was really this like brand awareness.
So you said like people were reaching out to you, people from the jury and things like that. Were people, even on socials, did you find that they were kind of like tagging you and stuff or like connecting with you through there?
That started to happen. Once I started taking social seriously, like that's when I started getting DMs. That's when I started getting people tagging me, asking for my opinion. Now, I'll tell you this, it can get a little frustrating early on because people are going to ask for stuff for free because they don't know you. You haven't built that brand. So like, even though I had all this experience as a trial lawyer and I'm like, the stuff that I'm doing is putting people in prison for the rest of life. Or I actually went out and did two cases on the defense because I thought two people were wrongfully accused of child abuse and murder. And I ended up winning both those cases too. Like the murder, even like the killing was actually on video, but I thought it was self-defense. Most people did not think we'd win that case and we did. So I'm sitting here thinking to myself like, hold on, I'm defending people and saving them from going to prison for the rest of their life when this is going on. And people are out here like, Robbie, can you give me free advice on this stuff? And so you get a little frustrated, right? But you have to be willing to just embrace that and say, hey, it's a new like, it's a new market. It's a new vertical I'm going in. I've got to educate people. I've got to show up. I've got to build credibility. And so I would just answer. I would talk to people. I'd give free coaching. I would do all these pieces and just give it away, because it's how you build that brand equity and build that surface area, so more people can talk about you and more people are willing to tag you. So your name just gets, you know, more prevalent in the space.
Absolutely. So now you're helping founders and other leaders in any field kind of become better speakers and storytellers. So we want to kind of shift into that and kind of understand that aspect of what you're doing. So first off, what is kind of your definition of a noteworthy story? Like, what would you say is a compelling story?
A noteworthy story is one that inspires action or changes the opinion of someone when they hear it. At its fundamental base, that is what it is. If you don't do one of those two, like, you have not told a compelling story.
For sure. And so do you have like a structure, any components that you would kind of highlight when you're creating or building out the story for whatever you're trying to communicate?
So obviously it depends on what the story purpose is, right? So like, we first have to understand like where our audience is and where we want to take them. So there's always like this almost empathetic view that we've got to take of our audience first and get into their shoes and see the world from their eyes. Once we do that, then we've got to identify. So essentially what I have is like a framework that I call the performative speaking framework. And that is a five-step framework. Two of them are strategy, three of them are more tactical. The first two are, what's your goal and what's the emotion that you want to create? Then the next three, which are tactical, is what's your hook, what's your theme, what's your dismount? At the end of the day, any sort of talk, any sort of story should be able to answer those key questions. Now, beyond that, there's frameworks within frameworks within frameworks of what's a go-to story. And that's similar. That's a simplified version of the hero's journey, right? And to me, that's adventure, adversity, triumph. And maybe you have a little bit of humor in there. There's founder origin story, which can be, where'd you come from? How'd you get here? Why do you care? You answer those pieces and you take them on. You have like a startup story, which I say is like your purpose, passion, potential pieces, and they're going to answer different questions throughout. There's a whole bunch of frameworks. I mean, we can think about classic structures of storytelling as well. Rags to riches, Cinderella, the journey, kind of all these different classic structures that we can look at. Man falls in a hole. There's a whole bunch of them. So to answer like what makes a compelling story, like that is on a case by case basis, really, because this is the problem in storytelling in this world right now. Too many people are trying to give people formulas for how to do this. Storytelling is not a formulaic thing. You have formulas that can work, but you've got to figure out what formula actually makes sense for your thing, and then you've got to play around with it. Storytelling is really part science, part art, and really all magic. And that's what it takes, instead of this formulaic approach that many people in the space, the gurus who just kind of want to make it simple for people, teach them. And then they don't actually end with a compelling story. They don't actually end where they are inspiring action or changing opinions. Sure, maybe they're sharing a story, but stories are entertaining. Storytelling is inspiring action, and there's a difference.
I'm glad you mentioned that in terms of gurus and things like that. I think we've seen that increase in popularity as social media use has increased as well. You know, I think we always get the sales pitch guys at the beginning of YouTube ads to be like, hey, well, I'm going to help you build this business that's like $1 million. And this is how you're going to take my script, you're going to take my formula, whatever that is, right? So when you run into people like that, could you kind of just give some insight into how people can avoid or things to look out for when they're trying to better themselves in this area, whether that's looking through mentors or anything like that? What should they be looking for and avoiding?
You know, the first piece when it comes to storytelling is, how good of a storyteller are they, right? If they're not good themselves, if they can't walk the walk, if they don't have any real experience doing the thing, run as fast as you possibly can, right? I mean, I didn't feel like I could teach this stuff until I tried a whole bunch of cases. And I also coached the National Mock Trial team for 4 years before I ever took this into this space, because I wanted to validate the idea. I wanted to make sure I could teach people how to do this and do it well. And I think a lot of people in today's world basically go through some sort of training about how to tell your story. And then they launch their thing about how I'm going to teach you to tell your story. And then that person takes it, and then they go and run a seminar around, I'm going to teach you how to tell your story. And it's like, but what are you actually teaching? Like, you're not actually moving the needle. You're just regurgitating information. So I think first off, you want to look for real results from the actual person teaching it. The second is, you want to find results from the people that have worked with them, right? Do the people that they teach actually get results, right? That's why for me, I'm super proud when I see all my clients going out and fundraising and getting these messages of like, this completely changed things. Right. You know, in 12 months, we're over $120 million fundraised at a seed and Series A level. I don't care if someone is like, Robbie, this doesn't work. Like, I'm just going to point you there and say, here you go. Like, you tell me. And I think if you don't have that proof as a storyteller, there's just like any business, right? There's no reason you should trust them. So when you're getting sold these ideas from people like, oh, I can teach you how to tell your story, what are your actual results? What are you delivering to people? And what are those people willing to say? Are they willing to refer people to you? Are they working with you 6, 9, 12 months later? Not because they need to, because they want to. And so that's where you start to see like who actually is walking the walk. And there's plenty of good storytelling people out there. Nancy Duarte, absolutely classic, so like well-credentialed, huge fan of what she does. You have Jeremy Connell Waite, who does incredible jobs. Rich Mulholland does really good work as well. So you've got a ton of people in the space who are doing incredible work around storytelling. We've just got to, you know, go out there and make sure that we're not falling into the trap of a lot of the charlatans.
And that was actually going to be my next question in terms of who do you find, especially in the business world today, that are great storytellers? So you mentioned a couple there. Can you kind of expand on that and tell us like what makes them specifically special?
I mean, they've devoted their lives to being storytellers. I think this is the piece that is always tough for people to realize is storytelling has become a buzzword. And it's like one of those like, oh, like, you know, it's like a nice to have. There are people who spend all of their time studying this stuff. Like I spend all my time studying storytelling and how to use that in a business context, especially in the startup world. And that means watching storytellers, breaking down, reading, watching speeches, seeing why it works, understanding psychology, game theory, how the brain science plays into it, all these different pieces. So like a Jeremy Connell Waite, like he does this for IBM. He is absolutely fantastic. Richard Mulholland, same thing. Absolutely fantastic. He does storytelling in more of like a sales setting. Nancy Duarte's been in the game since I think like early 2000s, right? She wrote a whole bunch of books around like data story and Resonate. And she's just one of the best at this. She gave the TED talk about how Martin Luther King Jr. structured his speech with the like, this is where we are. This is where we could be. This is where we are. This is where we could be. So you've got to be willing to like dive into that level and just study it all the time. So those people I really look up to. And then of course, great business leaders who invest in this as well. You know, whether it's Steve Jobs saying the most powerful person in the world is a storyteller. You've got, you know, people like Justin Kahn who says storytelling is what allowed him to raise $150 million as a startup founder. Alex Lieberman says it's one of the most important skills that you need. You can watch Sarah Blakely deliver story after story after story of how she built Spanx. You know, you can look at all sorts of people who are doing this really well. Even Jeff Bezos, when he gets in some hot water, like there was a moment that he was testifying in front of Congress about potential, you know, like collusion or whatever it was at one point. And they asked him for his testimony. And the first thing he starts is he just goes into his origin story. He literally backs up and gives his origin story for the very beginning of this entire piece of testimony. Why? Because he knows that story is going to like ground him as a human being. You know, he also had that saying where if the data and the antidotes from the customers don't match, you have bad data. So like we see this, great leaders understand the value of storytelling and continue to dive into it. Now, they're typically learning from somebody like a Nancy Duarte, like a Jeremy Connell Waite, like myself, because they don't have the time. They're building a business. They're world-class at what they do. So they're willing to say, hey, I'm going to bring in an expert who can condense the amount of time to deliver in a really meaningful way so that I can elevate this skill as quickly as possible.
I love the piece on Jeff Bezos. I think especially people like that, we're in high profile, where we're able to look into these conversations and, you know, we have that open access on YouTube or wherever you want to watch that. You can see those cues and see those little hints. Just one more point there, just kind of because we were talking about, you know, people on the charlatans of the world, especially sticking in the business world. One of the recent ones was the Theranos story. I don't know if you followed that, how closely you followed that, but also going back in time, we have Bernie Madoff and things like that. When you look at those high profile cases, can you pinpoint instances or hints where you're just like, hey, that didn't click or that didn't make sense? Like, does anything like that stand out to you?
You know, you also see it like they just put out the Netflix show Becoming Anna, right?
Yep,
the
yep.
Anna Delvey story.
Yep.
It's very, very similar. And so when you're looking at a story, you're trying to find a couple things. One, are there like real sensory details that show that like what they're talking about is real? So the example I'll give is this. If you talk to somebody about scuba diving and you have two people, one who's gone scuba diving and one who hasn't, the way that they describe scuba diving is going to be very, very different. The one who's never been is going to get some pieces right. They're going to be like, yeah, you put on the wetsuit, the scuba tank is on your back, you put on the mouthpiece, it's really weird to breathe in, and you jump in and like, you're just kind of freaking out at first, then you dive under and all of a sudden the world just opens up to you and you see the fish floating around and you see the coral and you're down there and you don't realize how long it is. Then you come back up and, you know, it's just an incredible experience. But the person who's actually been scuba diving is going to go way, way deeper. They can explain what the water feels like on their skin when they hit. They can talk about what the different depths feel like and the pressure and how that changes and the steps that they have to take to protect themselves when they come up. They can talk more about the mindset that's going on when you see maybe a shark swims by or something that frightens you a little bit and you don't know what it is, or the water's murky and how you deal with that. They're going to go so much deeper that you can tell they've really lived the thing instead of this surface level description. So one piece is looking for sensory details. The other is anytime someone's telling a story, if it's real, they should be able to move in and out of it at different pieces. So you should be able to drop somebody in the middle and say, tell me your story at this point moving forward. And you should say, drop them in the middle, tell it backwards to me. And you should be able to drop them 2/3 in, 1/3 in, over and over. And you should be able to move them throughout and they can just seamlessly move back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, because it's real, because they've experienced it. And so when I see something, you know, like a Theranos or Bernie Madoff or Anna Delvey, for instance, you can see a lot of generalizations, right? You see a lot of like this big, bold language, which is great, but there's very little detail. There's very little substance. And one of the tricks you learn in debate and extemporaneous speaking, which I competed in when I was in high school, is you're always trying to back up a point. If you can give one story or one thing that is like more specific, all of a sudden it becomes much more believable to your audience. And so on the flip side, when you're debating somebody, what you do is you push them. When they only go general, you push them for specific answers, specific points, specific stories. And when most of the time, if they're on that general level and they don't actually have it, they just crumble because they actually will lash out at you trying to come back at you because they don't have any depth to their answer. So when I see a storyteller like that, I'm looking for what are the specifics? Does it actually make sense? And oftentimes if you push them to go deeper, there's nothing there. Like this happens a lot with startup founders where you ask them like, how'd you come up with that number? And there's nothing there. There's like, I just pulled it out. They're like, that does not work. We've like, you need to be able to do the math behind this or else it screams that this is all just made up. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned there. Storytelling can be used for evil, right? 100%. We've seen that throughout history, right? We've seen that with, I mean, even very recently, the storytelling that's going on in the current Russia-Ukraine conflict shows us exactly what is possible to be done with storytelling. We look throughout history, any sort of dictator has used storytelling to try to create an us versus them dynamic because you can. So it's very, very troubling when you see it used maliciously, but we have to realize that's just a human fact. Like we are humans. At the end of the day, people are going to use it for their own purposes. And so we're trying to figure out how can we see through it when it's false. Don't get me wrong. If you're really good at it, it's really hard to pick up on its faults unless you are also a really talented storyteller and debater and have training in this sort of stuff. The normal average day person is not going to be able to see through it, to be completely honest.
Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction to make. A lot of individuals like maybe Elizabeth Holmes had a lot of practice doing that and making sure that she can sell that vision, having convinced so many large investors and stuff like that. You know, that makes us kind of go into this segment where I want to kind of talk about pitch decks and, you know, founders pitching to VCs. You know, I'd love to understand your thoughts on what founders get wrong with their pitch decks and or just the general story that they're trying to sell. Because you've worked with a lot of founders and, you know, a lot of them have found success. But, you know, working with them initially, what are the kind of mistakes that you're seeing on a consistent basis that some of these founders are making?
So the biggest mistake with pitch decks is they think they need one, which is going to be a somewhat controversial take. And I don't really care because you don't need a pitch deck to raise, especially early on. So you do not need a pitch deck pre-seed, seed, even Series A. You don't really need one. I know this because I've had founders raise without pitch decks at all those stages and raise from tier one VCs and raise big amounts. You do not need a pitch deck if you have a compelling story and know how to position it. So that's kind of the first one. I think everybody gets this idea. And don't get me wrong, there's a reason why that narrative is out there, because it makes life easier for VCs because they can just say, send me your pitch deck. And it's an easy way for them to quickly identify, is this a yes or a no? And so I get it. I understand why that is the narrative out there. But when the narrative is one way, you've got to find a way around it, right? So there's so much noise out there. How do you cut through? Well, you cut through by being different. If you're going to use a pitch deck, that's not to say there's anything inherently wrong if you want to. So a pitch deck serves two purposes, in my opinion. One, it helps the founder clarify their thinking because they have to go through the exercise to figure out what their story is in the pitch deck, some of the key metrics, some of the things that are going to stand out, right? So it forces them to kind of do their homework. That's benefit number one. Benefit number two is if you're not well connected in the space, you can use it as a way to attract attention and get that first meeting. That's really what it is a hook. Beyond that, it is in the pitch, in the call, it is completely pointless. You do not need to open that thing up when you're on a call talking to an investor. In today's world, it should be a collaborative conversation. And this is where I call what my approach is conversational storytelling. And we use this with story, like story blocks, as I call it. So every piece is kind of laid out where you're telling the story in a way that leads to the next question. So it's very conversational. It's very easy to go through. You're explaining the story about yourself, why you care about the startup, why it's going to succeed, and ultimately what the big potential is. That's really all you need. If you can do those pieces right, you're going to be just fine. So that's my hard stance on pitch decks. If we're talking about pitch deck kind of tactics and what people get wrong, there's just way too many slides. If you can't do it in 10 slides, you don't know your idea well enough. So like I have a hard and fast rule. It is 10 slides. If you're going to use one, it is 10 slides. And you need to figure out a way to make all the headlines tell a story. If I remove every other piece of information off the pitch deck, I should be able to know what your narrative is just from the headlines. And most people don't do that. Most people put the most boring headlines up there. They put the, what's the problem? Here's our solution. Meet our team. Just the worst. Just the worst. I mean, that's the exact same thing that everybody else does. How do you stand out when you do the exact same thing? And the answer is you don't. So like if you look at the numbers, VCs are looking at pitch decks for like 90, 120 seconds. That's the amount of time you get. So like you better do something that stands out that makes it memorable because they're seeing pitch deck after pitch deck after pitch deck. So that's the biggest one if we're actually talking tactics is make the headlines tell a story and it should not be more than 10 slides. You can have like an appendix that you share that has a whole bunch more, but your main pitch deck to get the attention, to get that meeting should just be 10 slides.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I've seen some founders go up to like 25 in some cases. And, you know, I do some venture scouting on the side and I just try to go down the first few slides and then just completely lost at that moment in time. It just makes no sense to me. And then just kind of reiterate that point you just made, like keep it short and sweet and make sure you're kind of, you know, resonating a story, a narrative that you're trying to build out. Maybe an extension to that question is, what are the importance of maybe visuals in a pitch deck? I've also seen, you know, way too many founders put too many words on a slide. It's just way too complicated. So how does those visuals also compel a strong story that can kind of say, you know, this startup is doing well or this is startup worth investing in?
My stance on pitch deck slides is that they should almost all be visual and there should be very little text on those slides, which is why your headline needs to tell the story. And then the slide itself is typically some sort of visual that explains what's going on. That could be your classic graph that shows up and to the right. It could be social proof from customers who are talking about your product or customers who are using your product. In fact, one of my favorite pitch decks I've ever seen was the Levels. I think it was their seed round that they raised, you know, $12, $15 million or whatever it was. And in that, it was just social proof after social proof after social proof. It was funny because I was reading through and I was like, I know, but like I would see the tweets and be like, oh, that's a friend of mine. That's a friend of mine. That's a friend of mine. But it was just littered with social proof of customers who are excited about what they're building. So as a VC, when you see there's a whole bunch of people ready to sign up and buy this thing, guess what? I'm ready to invest because now I know you've got customers, you've got product market fit. So I love social proof. And even though those are words, it's like a tweet, right? Or it's a comment on a LinkedIn post. So they're words, yes, but they're actually social proof. Then you obviously have graphs and addressable market sizes and different things like that, and pictures and product demos. Like if you have a product demo, great. Like that's something that shines through. Like use visuals more than words. The more words you have to use, the worse your pitch deck is going to be. Because again, the whole idea of a pitch deck is just to make a VC or an investor say, this is interesting. Robbie, tell me more about what you're building. And then you get on a call and you go through the actual story with them. So the more words you put on the sides, the more complicated it gets, the more red flags you potentially put out there, and the easier it is for an investor to say, no, not worth my time. Because if you have any friction, the investor is going to say, no, I can find one that is frictionless. I can find one that immediately says, I want to take this call.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And such an important point, just like having a frictionless experience, even when sending over a pitch deck is so critical, especially nowadays when VCs get a million decks within their emails. So, you know, one thing I'd love to understand, we'll get into, you know, how your program is specifically structured. But before that, are there any resources that maybe entrepreneurs can utilize to become, you know, better storytellers? Let's just say they haven't heard of Robbie before. And so, you know, what resources are out there to kind of help them with storytelling or help them narrate their founder origin story and stuff like that?
I mean, resources in terms of like a founder origin story is going to be tough. I mean, you can study a lot of storytelling ideas, right? There's books, there's Storyworthy by Matthew Dix, there's Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller. There's some other ones like Make It Stick. I forget another one that just the other day someone tagged me in. I mean, there's a number of storytelling books coming out. There's also plenty of YouTube videos. I mean, you can look at like GSB has a series from some of their teachers who talk about communication and these sort of pieces. You can study great speakers, right? That like the way that I learned a lot of it early on was I just went and watched the best trial lawyers in the courtroom. And on both sides, I didn't care which side they were on. I would just go and sit there in the courtroom and watch. Like I worked so many hours largely because during the day, I would just go and sit and watch people do this. And then I'd have to go and do my work because I knew that the best way to learn was watching what's working. And so go and watch like a Steve Jobs, right? Go and watch a Jeff Bezos. Go and watch a Sarah Blakely. Go and watch a Michelle Obama. Go and watch comedians. Go and watch rappers. Go and watch, like, it doesn't matter. There's so much value out there to study. You just have to be willing to do the work. And that's the tough part when it comes to storytelling. And that's ultimately why people do work with people and coaches around this skill, because essentially what you're taking is like all those years of time and condensing it into here are the pieces you actually need, right? So, I mean, like I have an inspiration list that I share with any of my clients of a bunch of different examples. And on that is, you know, a list of 150, 200. And it's, you know, some of it is television clips. Some of it is advertisements. Some of it is speeches. Some of it is press conferences. Some of it are congressional hearings. Some of it are like book quotes or different things from different sources, music videos, rappers, lyrics, comedians. And what you're doing is instead of you having to go and finding all of that, I'm just saying, hey, here's like a bunch of resources you can go and look at. So I mean, there's plenty of that out there. You can do a lot of the work yourself. It just is a time issue as you're going through it.
Got it. So, you know, now let's just say a founder decides to work with Robbie and kind of join you and kind of undertake your program. So what do you do to assess that individual's kind of current state in terms of their skill sets with regards to storytelling? And then from there, how do you kind of cater that program or, you know, structure that program so, you know, it really helps them kind of excel?
The first step is honestly, it's going to sound super simple, but this is what it is I just say, tell me your story. That's it. I don't give them any more guidance. I just say, tell me your story. And they inevitably tell me a terrible story just because it's just the nature of things. It's either way too long with a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't matter, or it's way too short and they like cut out all the good stuff. And so then I'll, depending on which one it is, I'll figure out which direction we need to go. And a lot of them oftentimes are too short and they don't focus on anything. And the way that I really cut through that is oftentimes I'm like, we'll start when you were 10. Tell me your story from like when you were 10. Because what you learn as a child abuse prosecutor and violent felony prosecutor trying all these things is so much of like what informs people long term is actually what happens to them in their childhood, in their youth. And so a lot of people are running startups because something happened to them when they were younger and they want to fix that. They want to change that, or it's still informing them, or there's some theme that's overarching in their lives of, I want to do this, right? It could be something as simple as, you know, like, my father was X, I want to prove to him that I'm every bit as good as he was. And like, that's why you're building your startup, like this sense of like, I've got to prove myself to them. Okay, like we can work with that. And then we're going to build out from there. So you've got to be willing to go into that. And then there's obviously like a whole bunch of learnings around structure, around conversational aspects, around tone, around delivery, around body language, around power dynamics. And so you just essentially go through all these pieces that I've distilled down into their like most basic fundamentals so you can learn them as quickly as possible and start implementing them, right? And for example, I was working with a founder just recently. We started working together and had gone through a bunch of meetings before and just was not finding success. And we completely reworked that story that he was going to tell. And it was one of those where when he left, he's like, I'm super uncomfortable with this. Like, this is not how I want to do it. And went and had a bunch of meetings, had five meetings, and ended up five meetings moving into a second meeting and a whole bunch of people being like, we need to figure out a way to get into this deal. And he was like, it was super uncomfortable, but it worked. And so there's this learning curve where we've got to figure out how to connect on a human level. And I think one of the big pieces that I work with any founder on is how to turn it from a business discussion into a human discussion. Because we always hear the term, right? People buy from people. An investor pitch is just a sale. It's a high ticket sale, if you will. That's what being a trial lawyer was too. Like, if we boil it down, it was like, I'm selling to the jury. Give me what I deserve. And a founder is doing the same thing. So we need to turn that into just like, hey, we're going to speak on a human level, because if you connect to me as a person, you're far more likely to say, I want to invest in this person.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to unlock, is like, stop turning it into a business discussion and start turning your story into a human story that they can connect with. And what I want to hear is investors saying like, ooh, like I know somebody that could benefit from this, or, ooh, that reminds me of this. I want them opening up and immediately turning that into a, like, we're just talking as human beings, because that's where the magic happens. Because now I say, I like this founder. I want to bet on them. They've got something special.
Yeah. No, I think that's an important point you made there. Maybe what I can relate this back to is, I was recently reading A Ride of a Lifetime, I think it's called, by Bob Iger, the Disney book. And one of the chapters he discusses where he had that conversation with Steve Jobs when they're acquiring Pixar. So Steve Jobs obviously had a bad relationship with the previous CEO, but what Bob Iger did was he came in with more of a human aspect in terms of building that relationship. And that's what Steve Jobs actually resonated to. And that's kind of why, you know, it was successful in the end, and making sure that relationship future with Pixar and Disney was successful, and why he also even accepted, you know, that deal in the first place. So I think that's super, super important, going from business to human side. It's really that trust that you enable to kind of help you kind of close that sale pitch or whatever it is. You know, one of the things I'd love to understand from you is, you've obviously built a brand around yourself now with obviously storytelling. And, you know, through that, you use a medium in terms of, you know, talking about that story, whether it's LinkedIn, Twitter, or whatever. Could you talk about the importance of using these channels and mediums as a resource to kind of grow your brand? And what have you found, or what techniques have you used that have enabled you to be successful?
Yeah, this is the part of scaling your influence, right? You've got to be out there getting that story just time and time again so that people know what you're about. And for me, early on, it was Twitter. And that was largely because so much of the tech world is on Twitter, right? It's very heavy there. So I was tweeting a lot just to get credibility and to get my name known. And that's really what it was about, which worked really well. But Twitter is not an incredible business platform, in my opinion, right? You don't get as many people coming inbound because it's not where they go for business. They go to learn. And it's totally fair. And like, I love giving information out there and teaching people and having that process play out. But over time, what I had to do is lean into other mediums like LinkedIn, like video. Especially for me, video is so compelling because I'm saying I can help you become a storyteller. Like I said, I've got to also show people I can do this thing and break down these ideas and talk to them. So for me, I really have focused a lot on LinkedIn recently because that's where so many people are focused on business. So if you're focused on business and I'm speaking about how I can help your business, it's a lot easier conversation to open up than on Twitter, where it's just like, deliver education. And education is much harder. You can't, you know, on an education post be like, what if you want to work with me, do X, Y, and Z. But on LinkedIn, honestly, people are so primed for business there that they just come inbound all the time. Yeah. They see it and they're like, I need that. That thing resonates. So for me, I'm always thinking about like, what are the best mediums to attract people? And I think one of the people who's actually done this really well over the last, you know, I don't know, 6-9 months is Alex Hormozi has just done an incredible job of building like a content brand around what he's doing. And you know, like most people will kind of look at him as like this internet marketer originally because he built a gym business, right? But like, dude's super smart and is building an entire portfolio of companies. I know he's just recently on Sam Parr and Shane Puri's podcast.
God. Yeah, I think I don't know. He's on. I've seen him on Instagram a couple of times, and his wife does the same thing now, yep. Right? Yeah, yeah, okay, got it.
And so they're the owners of Acquisition.com, and he wrote the book $100 Million Offers. And they're everywhere with content. And so I think for me, so much of it is just like continuing to create content and putting it out there in all these different mediums and letting people see it. Because like the further that you can put content out there, the easier it is for your message to spread and the easier it is for people to find you. So I think it's absolutely just critical in today's day and age where there's so much noise, but there's also just this ability to reach millions of people. Like I looked at a tweet I had the other day, a thread around storytelling, and it's now been seen by 400,000 people.
Wow.
Which to me is nuts. Like 400,000 people is larger than any stadium that we have in the US. And if I was ever to think I could get an entire stadium of people there and just talk to them about storytelling, I'd be like, that's crazy. But here you are on Twitter having that happen. And so I think that's really the cool piece where you can use these mediums to really teach and help a lot of people. And part of it too, I see social media as a way to honestly like give back because working with me is so expensive. And it's like a lot of people can't afford that. And I know that. And like, I don't want it only to be like, you only get to know this stuff if you pay a bunch of money to work with me. Right. And so social media is a way to continue to give back and say, hey, I appreciate that. Like I get to work with really incredible people who can afford this. But I know there's plenty of people out there that can't. So like, let's continue to give these lessons and you can implement them yourselves, which obviously doesn't take my time and is going to be less effective. But ultimately, at least you have the skills and the understanding of what to do.
Got it. Yeah. So you're obviously leveraging giving back to your users or, you know, potential future clients. And then once, you know, maybe they're convinced, they'll obviously work with you and go the monetary route if need be, right? So that totally makes sense in that, in terms of that strategy. So, you know, one thing I love to do within our podcast is kind of get like philosophical for a minute. So, you know, I found that a lot of founders today are starting to place a lot more weight on, you know, status. So, you know, using those titles, Forbes under 30 or 30 under 30 and stuff like that, versus, you know, sometimes working and developing a long-term business. So maybe what I can relate this to is if you kind of think about, say, Shopify CEO, a lot of individuals had never heard of this individual until maybe recently, maybe until they went public. Maybe in the tech circle, obviously, that makes sense. But as a public, a lot of people haven't heard of him, his name, and maybe even today don't even know who he is, right? So he focused solely on kind of credibility through his business. So what are your thoughts on this trend of validation through status per se versus, you know, creating long-term value through actually building a tangible business?
I mean, obviously, I think that you need to build a tangible business. So you can't just do the status play. That's where you get the Elizabeth Holmes type characters who are just playing a status game. That being said, there's a value to the status games in helping you build a long-term valuable business. It's easier to fundraise if you have greater distribution, right? If you have Forbes 30 under 30, guess what? People are going to see that on your LinkedIn or on your Twitter, and they're more likely to follow you because they think that you have some sort of special quality. Well, if more people follow you, that means your distribution is greater, which means your potential customer base is larger. So there are real benefits to that, right? There's nothing wrong with using social proof and status to further the business you're building as long as you're keeping in mind, what are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to impact others and have a net positive kind of outcome? If you are, then use everything that you can to grow that. I think if you are actually impacting people and helping them, you should use every tool at your disposal to do it better. But if you're only doing it for status, that's where things become problematic. And you see a lot of that in today's world. You see a lot of that where people will give themselves like a CEO title before they're running, you know, they're running like a one person business. You're not a CEO. Like you're an entrepreneur. You're a solopreneur. Like you're a founder, whatever you want to call it. Like that's totally cool. But you've got to be very, very careful in not giving kind of these false impressions to people and not focus purely on status, but use status as a way to drive business growth and have a greater impact on people. I think that's totally fair.
Absolutely. Got it. And do you feel like as a individual, someone can actually see through authenticity and kind of that, maybe not initially, but over time, as you kind of pitch that story and maybe status is the only thing that you're focusing on, do you think people start understanding that's not truly authentic in terms of that narrative that you're trying to build out?
Depends on the person. I mean, you certainly could. I also think that there is a bit of a misconception around authenticity these days. So I think that part of the problem is people think authenticity means I've got to either share everything about myself or like there's only one way about myself, right? And that I always use the example. When I was younger, I didn't like coffee. I hate it. I wouldn't drink it. Now I drink coffee all the time. Was I inauthentic when I was younger or am I inauthentic now? Because, well, back then I said I hate coffee. I'm not a coffee lover. But now I'm a coffee lover. So like, am I inauthentic in one of those two? And I say, no, you're growing. So authenticity is like this elastic thing. It actually changes over time. And we also have different pieces of ourselves. We have multiple parts of our being. And so if I'm speaking to a lawyer, a judge, I'm going to speak very differently than I am if I'm speaking around my friends who I've known forever versus, you know, I'm going to speak very differently in a CrossFit gym or like, you know, Gold's Gym in Venice than I am in a Silicon Valley boardroom talking to a bunch of VCs. They're all different. That doesn't mean that I'm being inauthentic. It just means I'm leaning on different pieces of me and identifying what percentages of each piece should I bring into this conversation. So I think that that's also one thing to realize. What happens is the authenticity thing becomes like a, you can feel when someone's inauthentic, when it feels very cardboard, when it feels like essentially if you dug anywhere, you would find all these holes where it feels like basically an actor. This is part of the problem with some speech storytelling coaches is they are actors, and there's nothing wrong with actors. There's a ton of value to what they bring. Like I've worked with a bunch of them too, because I want to learn from their craft. But acting is very different than being authentic and delivering the best story. So we always have to try to figure out, is the person presenting themselves as something they think people want to see, but that's not really who they are? Or are they presenting themselves as what people want to see, but that is truly who they are, or at least a piece of who they are? It's that best version for that audience. So I think there's a distinction there. We want to make sure that authenticity doesn't become this shield to prevent us from growing and from pushing ourselves to continue to develop.
For sure. Going back to that coffee analogy, I think that was a really interesting point on the idea of growth. People don't acknowledge the back end of all of what leads up to the success, right? I think in society, we typically tend to reward the success stories. I mean, we love that hero story, but we don't want to dive too much into the details behind that. So just on that point, kind of where does failure sit within the scope of telling an effective story for you? Because I think that's an important aspect of everyone's story.
I love failure in stories as long as there is some sort of triumph over that.
Yeah.
That's the key. And so that's why like my go-to story framework is adventure, adversity, and triumph. And adversity oftentimes is failure, but it's overcoming that and then being triumphant. The failure is what makes us human. It's what connects. It shows us being vulnerable. So an audience loves that. But the triumph is what shows them that they should bet on us. And the problem is too many people will focus on failures as if like the failure is this like badge of armor. And it's not. The failure is a badge of armor when you take that failure and you learn from it and you improve and you do something different, right? That's the difference. So in a story, there should be some sort of struggle. There should be some sort of obstacle. There should be some sort of failure. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, I mean, I put out on one of my videos on LinkedIn about when I was starting all this and left the legal career behind, I had completely maxed out my credit cards. Like I really thought that I was going to fail. Like I was not bringing in a bunch of income. I was not having a ton of success early on as I was trying to build out this brand. And so you go into this and then you show like how things improved. Or one of the cases that really changed my legal career was I lost my 8th jury trial. it was probably the most defining moment of my legal career, because that moment taught me what I needed to go and study, what I needed to learn, what I needed to get better at. And had I not have failed in that moment, I wouldn't have been prepared for these bigger cases, the robberies, the murders, the capital murders, the child abuse cases. Because I failed, I took that and I learned from that, and then I improved upon it. And that's what we want to achieve in these stories is, hey, I did fail. And it's okay to fail because you learn from it and you grow. And really the only form of failure is either not trying, or when you fail, not trying to improve from it.
Got it.
I think those are the only ways you truly fail.
I think that's a great way to kind of round out the podcast. I think, like you said, we like to end with triumphant ends as well. And so when we finish our podcast, what we like to do is do a little lightning round where we toss some quick questions at you just to get, the first answer that comes to mind here. So we're going to ask you maybe 4 to 5 questions.
Sure.
So you may have mentioned some of these books already, but can you tell us kind of your favorite book of all time? It doesn't have to be work-related. It can be something leisure or, you know.
I'm going to give 3. I'm going to cheat a little bit, but Gates of Fire by Stephen Pressfield, Lord of the Rings, and then Dune.
Dude, all right. We haven't heard that one. If you can have dinner with one person at any point in time, who would that be?
Well, at any point of time. Okay. Anthony Bourdain.
Can you name one company or client that excites you the most right now, currently?
I can name a bunch, but I'm not going to do any of my clients like that. They're all, honestly, all my clients out there just doing incredible things. Sam Parr recently featured 2 of them on his reels. People can go and try to figure out who those are, but I love all my clients. I'm lucky. I get to work with a bunch of great people, and I get to kind of hand choose who I get to work with at this point. And as a result, I get to have a ton of fun. So I can't sell anyone as better than the others, because they're all just doing great things.
That's fair. So outside of clients, any companies that are exciting you right now?
Any companies that are exciting me? I think it's really cool what Levels is doing in the health space right now. I think what their mission is very exciting. So I think that's something the world needs, is a lot more ownership of health data and kind of disrupting a lot of those areas. So as a Texas boy, I like some liberty and freedom. So when I know that, like, hey, I get to control my own medical data, that's something that's exciting.
Absolutely. Throughout the podcast, you've dropped a lot of, or maybe a few, controversial takes here, but we like to have one controversial question to round this out. Do you like pineapples on your pizza?
It's fine. It wouldn't be my preferred thing, but it's fine. I had to go back. You know, I don't eat a ton of pizza, to be honest. So that was, I had to go pretty deep into the bank, into the memory bank there of, like, when's the last time I had that? And that's why I was like, it's fine. It's not what I would order, but it's fine.
For sure. For sure. Robbie, thank you so much. This was a great podcast. Where can people find you? Where would you like people to connect with you, if at all? Any last words here?
Yeah, best places are LinkedIn, which you can just search Robbie Crabtree. You'll find me. I don't think anybody has my name or is writing posts nearly as often as I am. And then you can also find me on Twitter at Robbie Crab. Those are 2 good sources. My website is robbiecrabtree.com. So you can go there as well if you want to, like, read more from what I've done or different things. That's due for an update, so that'll be coming soon. But feel free to reach out. If I can help, happy to either, you know, point you in the right direction or talk or figure out ways to support great founders and people who are looking to just become great storytellers and basically live that whole idea of Steve Jobs, right? The most powerful person in the world is a storyteller. They set the vision, the values, and the agenda for an entire generation to come. I want more great storytellers doing that.